What we are going to do today, we are going to consider the specific differential equations and find the ways how to solve them and consider the forms of the Green's functions. So today we're going to consider heat and diffusion, or diffusion, it is called in the other way. It can be either called heat or diffusion. Heat or diffusion equation, and the heat curl that solves this equation. And then we're going to talk about Laplace and Poisson equations and Green's functions for Laplace operator. Okay, if you have any questions, of course, don't hesitate to ask. So consider the equation d phi of x t over dt equal to kappa nabla squared phi of x t. This is the heat or diffusion equation that belongs to the parabolic type of second order differential equations. And suppose that we specify the initial conditions for field phi, namely phi of x at the moment of time equal to 0 is equal to u naught of x, where u naught of x is some function that is presumably Fourier transformable and the function that decays fast enough in space. So how are we going to solve this equation subject to this initial condition? We will Fourier transform. Fourier transform both sides. We Fourier transform with respect to spatial variables the function phi itself, and Fourier transform u naught of x. Write phi of x t equal to the integral over the whole space. We're solving the problem where x belongs to the whole space. So the domain is the whole space. Phi k comma t, e in power minus a k dot x, dt over 2 pi in power d. And the same for u naught. I will write this way. U naught of x. Here u naught of k, just to save time. So this integral. Okay, good. Good. Hopefully this is clear. And we plug the Fourier transform into this equation, because Fourier components are all independent, as they should be. We can write down the equation for each Fourier component. We have d phi k t over dt equal to minus kappa k squared phi k comma t. So this is the first order differential equation with respect to time, and all of us know what the solution is. Phi k comma t is equal to phi k naught e in power minus kappa k k squared t. But what's this? This is nothing else than Fourier component u of k, u naught of k, this one. So in order to find how the whole field phi of x and t evolves with time, we need to substitute this expression into the formula for the reverse Fourier transform, for inverse Fourier transform, sorry. So we're going to have phi of x t equal to integral over the whole space u naught of k e minus ik dot x e
minus kappa k squared t to the k over 2 pi in power d. Good. We're going to do after this one more trick. Instead of u naught of k, we substitute the inverse Fourier transform so that we express back u naught of k via u naught of x. The integral over the space, then another integral over d xi, u naught of xi, e I k xi. E in power minus I k x, e minus kappa k square root t dk over 2 pi d. So is this clear what has been done here? We just took this u naught of k and substituted the expression for inverse Fourier transform. The variable of integration is labeled as xi. Okay, and in this formula, we can switch the order of integration. We can integrate over k and obtain the expression that contains the integral only over xi. So we use the fact, so using the fact that the integral over whole space d k over 2 pi in power d of e I k dot x minus xi e minus kappa k square t equal to 1 over 4 pi kappa t in power d over 2 exponent minus 1 over 4 kappa t x minus psi squared. So you should refer to the previous lecture if you want to check the formulas that are relevant for the calculation of this integral. And using this, we get psi of x comma t equal to the integral over whole space k x minus xi comma t u naught of xi d xi, where this quantity called heat kernel is equal to the following: k xi, sorry, x minus xi t equal to 1 over 4 pi kappa t in power d over 2. We're working in d-dimensional space, exponent minus 1 over 4 kappa t x minus xi squared. So we obtained the solution to the heat equation that satisfies the initial boundary conditions. Yes?
Can I ask, you did on the first blackboard, you did the first Fourier transform, that's how you got the k in the equation.
Uh-huh.
And then you did another Fourier transform, but with like the same Fourier variable. Is that allowed?
what do you mean by the same Fourier variable?
When you do the second Fourier transform,
where on the first board?
On the second board. On
here.
Board,
here.
You do the integration over k, which you assume is the same k that you had before.
Yes. You can do this. Yes. You can do this. The only thing that you should label the variable of integration differently. Here we have x, but here we have xi. But it's a completely legitimate trick. You can do this having one and the same k here and here. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's just a little confusing for me, and I think I follow it, but might be what is causing David's confusion is that u naught of k and u naught of c are different functions, right? I mean, the one's the Fourier transform of the other, but they're both called u naught, and we're only distinguishing them by what variable they're of,
They're different.
I think I'm following.
Yeah, u naught of k and u naught of xi, they are different functions. One is the Fourier transform of the other, and the second is the inverse Fourier transform of the first.
And u of psi of c is what we is the same thing as u of x, but just different variables.
I simply label with one on and the same letter the function itself and its Fourier transform.
Mm-hmm.
Only when you see the argument equal to k, then you talk about the Fourier transform of u naught of x.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I was more concerned about the case where you have there in the in with the cup there, that's here.
Yeah. Okay, k squared. Well, k squared arises when you apply the Laplace operator and the integral of Fourier transform function. Okay, any other questions? So, okay, to continue, I will mention one property, and you can, if you wish, of course, prove it as an exercise. So his kernel, note, k of x minus xi, comma t, possesses the so-called semi-group property. Namely, we have k of x minus xi t1 plus t2 equal to the integral of the whole space of the following construction. D eta, where eta is also the special variable, kx minus eta t1, then k eta minus xi t2. You can just prove this as an exercise. This will allow you to practice one more. Yeah.
Is this called a semigroup because there's no inverse, right?
Yeah, there is no backward transformation. Yeah. So, okay, good. What we're going to do next? We're going to construct the causal Green's function for the heat or diffusion operator. Causal Green's function for L equal to d over dt minus, so yeah, I have kappa nabla squared. Thank you. The procedure is very similar to what we have just done. What we are going to do, we are going to write down the equation, Green's function at base, d over dt minus kappa nabla squared, g of x. So nabla acts on x, minus x minus xi, t minus tau, equal to the delta function, or better to say the product of delta functions. Delta of x minus xi, delta of t minus tau. Again, we have delta functions in the right-hand side, and Green's function in the left-hand side, and we can Fourier transform both sides. We can substitute the Fourier transform for the Green's function and the Fourier transform for the product of these delta functions. So what we are going to write, I will go to this board, will be the following. So again, this g of x minus xi t minus tau and delta of x minus xi delta t minus tau will be given by the integral of the whole space, then integral from minus to infinity with respect to frequency variable, d omega over 2 pi. This is the integral over frequency, and the integral over k space dk divided 2 pi over d, right? And we have either the Fourier components of this Green function, k omega, what should I write here? If we have the Fourier expansion for delta function,
one.
And then e minus I k x minus xi e minus I omega t minus tau. So when we substitute these Fourier expansions, this Fourier transform, into this equation, we will have minus I omega plus kappa k squared g k omega equal to 1. Does everyone understand how we obtained this equation? Okay. We just perform the differentiation under the signs of integrals. So as a result, g k omega equal to 1 divided by minus I omega plus kappa k squared. So what we are left with, we have to plug this expression back into the formula for the Fourier transform of Green's function and get g of x minus xi t minus tau equal to the integral over the whole space, the integral from minus infinity to infinity d omega over 2 pi dk over 2 pi in power d, and then 1 over minus I omega plus kappa k squared e minus I k x minus psi e minus I omega t minus tau, right? Then what can we do? We have to take the integrals over the omega and dk. The simplest integral is the integral over the omega. We have the expression that contains only one pole here, only one pole that lies in the lower plane. So we have to admit that when t minus tau is smaller than zero, then we close the contour in the upper plane and get identical zero. However, if t minus tau is greater than zero, then we have to close the contour in the lower plane and get the non-zero result. It is completely similar to what we had yesterday. So thus, the Green's function for the heat kernel is automatically causal, because it contains only one pole, as provided by the nature of the heat of diffusion equation. This just means that the process can propagate in time only in one direction. If we have initial conditions, then we ask what the solution is going to be for the next moment. So we take the integral over omega and get theta t minus tau times the integral over dk over 2 pi in power d, e in power minus kappa k squared t minus tau, e minus ik x minus xi. And what's this? This is nothing else than the heat kernel given by this expression. Only instead of t, we have t minus tau. So we write that this is theta of t minus tau, k x minus xi, comma t minus tau. So the Green's function has automatically the causal structure. Any questions? If you have any questions, just go ahead. If I'm going too fast, just don't hesitate to stop me and ask questions, please.
Can you explain this causal thing here with the poles?
Why do we have theta function?
Yeah, I can see that, but it's a little confusing. So from the poles, how can we say that?
So this fraction has only one pole. Pole at omega equal to minus I kappa k squared, right? Mm-hmm. So this pole lies in the lower plane, so right here. Mm-hmm. So if this is the complex plane of omega, then pole is here on the real axis in the lower half. Then we need to take the integral over omega, and we have exponent in power minus a omega times something, times t minus tau. Yeah. So the correct way to calculate this integral is to look at the sign of t minus tau. If t minus tau is negative, then in order for the integral to converge, we must use the contour and close it in the upper plane. And if t minus tau is greater than zero, then we must close it in the lower plane. Because the upper plane has no poles, there is no contribution, so the integral will be zero. And if we close it in the lower plane, then we will get non-zero contribution. OK, any other questions? Yeah.
Would it not be possible to solve given a future boundary condition?
Future boundary. Oh, it's a very, very, very good question. So this equation contains the first derivative. Is that when you make the substitution t to minus t, then you get the other equation. So for this type of problem, it won't be possible.
It will not be.
Yeah. It will not be possible. Yeah. So another situation is with the so-called wave equation we're going to consider tomorrow. This wave equation will contain the second derivative with respect to time. And it is invariant under the change of sign for the time variable. So processes for wave equation can follow in both directions. Here, the evolution can follow only in one direction. This is the nature of the heat equation.
Is the backwards propagation impossible because the forwards propagation is not surjective or not injective?
What do you mean by not
injective? Is it for a given future boundary condition, can you not backwards propagate it because no initial condition would give you that, or because two initial conditions would give you that?
Well, I believe...
it's similar, because it's the error that increases when you try to propagate it backwards, so it could be many.
Many initial conditions may give one the same. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Because we are done with this topic, and we're going to switch to another partial differential equation. Okay. Very good. Topic Laplace and Poisson equations. So suppose we have the Poisson equation delta squared phi of x equal to f of x. This equation that contains the Laplacian or Laplace operator Navier squared is called the Poisson equation. Poisson equation. This equation belongs to elliptic type and contains no time. If f is equal to 0, then we have the Laplace equation. Laplace equation. The methods, how one can solve them, are pretty much similar. But nevertheless, depending on whether right-hand side is equal to 0 or not, these equations bear different names. These equations are supplemented by specific boundary conditions. Boundary conditions for Poisson Laplace equations, can be either of Dirichlet type, namely, we have some domain in space, omega. We have the boundary that is labeled by d omega, and we have the normal at every point on the boundary labeled as n. And the boundary conditions for those equations can be of two types. First, Dirichlet boundary condition. Dirichlet. Namely, the function is specified on the boundary. So the field phi is specified on the boundary. And we know what the field on the boundary is equal to. Phi of x is equal to g of x, x belonging to the boundary, or Neumann boundary conditions. Dirichlet or, that's to say, Neumann. the normal outward derivative is specified on the boundary, namely n dot nabla phi of x equal to g of x for x belonging to the boundary. Either the function itself or the derivative with respect to norm. So these are the only two boundary conditions that are used in the problems involving Poisson or Laplace equations. Before we consider the Green's functions used to solve Poisson equations, it is reasonable to spend some time talking about some theorems that a Laplace operator obeys, or better to say, Laplace, the theorems that allow us to solve the Laplace equation. Theorem one. For Dirichlet or Neumann boundary conditions, I will label them as BC. So BC will mean boundary conditions. For Dirichlet or Neumann boundary conditions, their solution is either uniquely for Dirichlet boundary conditions or up to a constant determined by g of r, so sorry, g of x, yeah, I call it x, on d omega. So if we have the Dirichlet boundary conditions, but all we need to know in order to determine a unique solution is the value of phi on the boundary. And for the Neumann boundary conditions, all we need to know to determine the solution up to a constant is what the derivative is equal at the boundary. So how are we going to prove this? Proof. Well, proof is very similar. So the method of proof is very similar to the method I suggest to use during the previous tutorial. We assume that we have two functions. Suppose we have two functions, phi 1 and phi 2, satisfying Laplace equation and the same boundary conditions. Then their difference, chi equal to phi 1 minus 2 phi, also satisfies minus delta squared chi equal to 0, and 0 boundary conditions. And at base, either chi equal to 0 on the omega, this way, or n dot nabla chi equal to 0 on the omega for Neumann boundary conditions. So by the way, just an important note. A function that satisfies Laplace equation being minus nabla squared phi equal to zero, a function phi, a being minus double of squared phi equal to zero is called harmonic. So I don't know anything about the origin of this name, why the function satisfying the Laplace equation is called harmonic, but this is what people use in the literature. When they talk about harmonic functions, they imply, of course, in the theories involving partial differential equations, they imply that the function satisfies the Laplace equation. They also use the term biharmonic function. This is the function that satisfies the equation that has two Laplace operators. So, this is just what you should know. Okay, let's return to the proof. Suppose we have two functions and take their difference. Then, since we have minus double squared chi equal to zero, we can take the integral over the whole domain omega. So integral minus double squared chi dx, the integral is over the volume of domain written above. And what we can do, we can perform the integration by parts, or in other words, use the Gauss's theorem in d dimensions. So it is equal to, we transform the integral over volume into the integral over the surface that encompasses this volume, equal to d omega chi times n dot nabla chi ds. ds is the element of the surface. So if this is n, the normal perpendicular to the surface, then this is ds. Now, if we look carefully at this integral, that if we have Dirichlet boundary conditions, then chi is equal to zero on the boundary, and we have this integral equal to zero. And if we have normal boundary conditions, then this is equal to zero. So, and this right-hand side is always equal to zero. From this, we can claim that if we have Dirichlet boundary conditions, then chi must be necessarily equal to zero, and both functions phi 1 and phi 2 be identical. And if we have Neumann boundary conditions, then we can claim that chi can be equal to constant. Indeed, this is equal to zero, so right-hand side is equal to zero, and Nabla operator applied to constant gives us also zero. So that's the statement that is the essence of this theorem follows from the equality to zero of the right-hand side. Okay, any questions how we did?
But don't we have the left-hand side zero already, right?
So.
So this just, I mean, how are we showing that psi is a constant?
Well, we can have, if we substitute instead of chi some constant, then it will satisfy the Laplace equation.
The only solution to the Laplace equation satisfies both that and the boundary and that and the boundary is zero.
I don't know, but it's kind of how to show that.
So you try to understand how we can have constant when we have non-boundary conditions, right?
I'm just trying to understand, like, are you planning to prove the theorem here? I definitely don't disagree with that theorem. I think it's correct. I just don't see the proof.
You just don't see the proof. So we have two functions, phi 1 and phi 2. And assume that they both satisfy the same boundary condition. And that they both satisfy Laplace equation.
Yeah, But how do we prove that if we have a function that satisfies the class equation above and is zero on the boundary, or if its normal derivative is zero on the boundary, then it's zero everywhere?
Because very, very good. Actually, chi can be complex. Yeah, very, very good.
Zero or constant.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I wrote very, very good. Thank you very much. I wrote the wrong thing here. We took nabla kappa. Thank you. Yeah. Or if kappa is real, we assume real squared. We took nabla kappa squared and applied the Gauss's theorem. Thank you. So what is nabla kappa squared? It's nabla kappa, yeah. Thank you very much. Times nabla kappa. And what we did, we integrated by parts this term. So we flipped the derivative from kappa to derivative with respect to this expression.
And that's zero.
Yeah. Yeah, and then we applied the Gauss's theorem. Yeah, we integrated by parts, flipped the derivative, used the Laplace equation. Yeah, I should have written more steps to
clarify. You have an ordinary differential equation of the first order, and then if that is zero, then it means that it's zero.
Yes.
And it's zero. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very good. So yes, let me write in the better way, of course, because it's not very clear. So integral over omega. So we have nabla chi dx. Then we have nabla. Chi times chi minus nabla squared chi times chi dx. So this is zero, and here we do the integration by parts. Gauss's theorem. So we have integral over the omega n dot nabla chi and one more chi over the s. Yeah, this is how it should be written. This is zero, but because chi satisfies the Laplace equation. So, okay, I hope this is clear now. Theorem number two. So for a solution of Poisson equation, Poisson equation minus delta squared phi equal to f to exist g of x must satisfy the Fredholm constraint. Given by the following formula. The integral of g ds over the boundary plus the integral over the volume of domain f dx equal to 0.
Is this like equivalent? If it satisfies this condition, then the dead eye solution loses?
Yeah. Okay. So if f, if this condition is not satisfied, then the solution is impossible. The solution that doesn't exist. So proof is very similar. So we have nabla squared phi integrated over volume, nabla squared phi dx. So, yeah, proof. Integral over volume of the domain, nabla squared phi dx. We do the same trick, the same trick as we did here, and transform this integral over the volume of domain into the integral over the boundary, the omega n dot nabla phi ds. Equal to the integral over the boundary g ds. Why? Because this is nothing else than g. We assume the Neumann boundary conditions, and we must have that n dot nabla acting on phi equal to g. And this is equal to minus f. Yeah.
Isn't it true that it's missing a phi on the second integral? Maybe?
No. So one second. Phi. No, it does miss. What we did, we have nabla squared phi equal to nabla dot nabla phi. Right? And we apply the Gauss's theorem to this vector, nabla phi. So thus we get n dot nabla phi times dx. So here no. So from this expression, we can easily deduce that f integrated over the volume equal to minus g integrated over the surface encompassing this volume. And finally, theorem number 3. Theorem
3.
Laplace operator L equal to minus nabla squared is self-adjoint. With respect to the inner product integral over volume phi star kappa dx. So the meaning of the inner product is similar to the meaning we used when we considered differential operators that are functions of only one variable. So, and the proof of self-adjointness is very similar. Only here we have to use the integration by parts and apply the Gauss's theorem rather than the boundary conditions imposed on the ends of the segment as we did for one-dimensional case. Proof. So, integral over volume, phi star minus nabla squared acting on chi minus chi minus nabla squared acting on phi star dx. So this is basically right phi star L chi minus chi L phi star. So again, we do the, so in each of those formulas, we flip the derivative onto the other function and write omega minus nabla phi star nabla chi minus nabla minus chi nabla acting on phi star dx. Is this clear how we move from this formula to this? It is just easy to check if we apply a nabla to each of the terms standing in each of the products. Then if we apply a nabla to phi star, then it will cancel with the term that results if we apply nabla to this guy. So, and then we again use the Gauss's theorem and get transform the integral over volume to the integral over the surface and get minus integral over the surface of phi star nabla chi minus chi nabla phi ds. What we're left to do? We're left to assume that both phi star and chi satisfy either Dirichlet boundary conditions or Neumann boundary conditions. If they satisfy Dirichlet boundary conditions, then phi star and kappa are equal to g on the boundary, and this integral is equal to zero. If they satisfy Neumann boundary conditions, then actually here we must have m, of course. Here, nabla operator, vector operator, S. If they satisfy Neumann boundary conditions, then n dot nabla acting on either chi or phi is equal to g, and the function itself is determined up to a constant. So you can have chi equal to, say, phi star plus some constant. Then in this case, you can check that the right-hand side is also equal to 0. So this is equal to 0 because of imposed boundary conditions on chi and phi star. So this completes the proof that Laplace operator is self-adjoint.
But isn't it, if it has to be a self-adjoint operator, that's not the solution there. It's got to be a self-adjoint on any.
So it will be self-adjoint if it is supplemented by the Dirichlet or Neumann boundary conditions. So we can talk about self-adjointness only when we have in mind the boundary conditions for the function it acts on. Okay, any other questions, guys? Okay, if there are no questions, let me make the following note. Just a note that let me take another chart. Note, how can one solve Laplace equation? Minus nabla squared phi equal to 0. So I'm aware, for this particular equation, I'm aware of only one method, the method of separation of variables. So I can't think of anything else. So of course, if you have a one-dimensional problem, then the solution is known and trivial. But if you have the multi-dimensional problem involving complicated boundaries, then the only method I'm aware of is the method of separation of variables. So the best method is the method of separation of variables. But we're not going to talk about this because we don't have enough time. If we talk about this, we won't have enough time to consider more interesting cases involving Green's functions. Yeah?
Is it like both the boundary conditions, like the Neumann boundary conditions?
Yeah, only for Neumann boundary. Only for Neumann. So you can see that Neumann boundary conditions are more restrictive than the Dirichlet boundary conditions. So, okay, my friends, let me move forward. Consider the following topic, Green's function for Laplace operator. So suppose we have some domain omega, boundary d omega, and the outward normal n at each point of the boundary. Then we have the differential equation for Green's functions, minus number squared acting on the first argument, x, g of x, comma, x prime, equal to delta function. To delta of x minus x prime. The question is how to solve this equation that will determine the Green's function and will allow us to solve Poisson equation. First of all, we have just proven that Laplace operator is self-adjoint. What does this mean? This means that it has the set, the complete set of eigenfunctions and eigenvalues. So this is according to a very general theorem that is valid in any dimension. Thus, we can do the expansion with respect to eigenfunctions. So if minus number squared acting on eigenfunctions of Laplace operator of x are equal to lambda n, index n labels, enumerates the eigenfunctions, equals to lambda n pi of n x, then we can write that then g of x, comma x prime, equal to the sum over n in denominator lambda n, in numerator phi n x, phi n star x prime. We could write this down because Laplace operator is self-adjoint. And we have just proven this. Consider just a simple case. In general, of course, we have to determine the Green's function that satisfies appropriate boundary conditions, the conditions on the boundary, and in general for an arbitrary domain, it's complicated, but let's first solve a simple problem, assuming that X belongs to the whole space. So if X belongs to the whole real space RD, and we are considering d-dimensional case, then we use phi of x. Can anyone tell me what the eigen functions are going to be if we have the whole space? Without any actual, if we have the whole space, domain isn't bounded, then what are the eigenfunctions of this Laplace operators and what should stand instead of n and lambda? Just remember how you solved the Schrödinger equation for the freely moving particle.
E to the IKX.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we use phi. Instead of n, we use the wave vector k. Phi kx equal to I k dot x, and lambda k will be equal to k squared. Right, if we plug those there, we will get that the equation is satisfied. Then we use this formula. Instead of summation of n, we use the integral over the whole Fourier space. And g x comma x prime equal to the integral dk over 2 pi d, 1 over k squared times e in power I k dot x minus x prime. So here, of course, because the system is translationally invariant, and this is very important, we have that the Green's function is not just the function of x and x prime, but the function of x minus x prime. So whenever you see this situation, this already implies that this system is translationally invariant. For the bounded area, of course, we will not be able to make this conclusion. So a question, how can one calculate this integral? Let's assume that this is the d-dimensional integral and we're working in d-dimensional space. We will use the so-called Schwinger trick. The integral is non-trivial because we have 1 over k squared as a prefactor. We have k squared in denominator. So what we're going to do, we're going to write as follows. G of x minus x prime equal to the integral from 0 to infinity over ds integral dk over 2 pi e power d, e I k dot x minus x prime times e in power minus s k squared. This trick is called Schwinger trick. Schwinger's trick. So it is often used in field theory when people calculate Feynman diagrams. Complicated Feynman diagrams. They basically lift what stands in denominator into numerator so that what stands in denominator appears under the sign of exponent. Schwinger's trick. If you integrate over S, one over k squared will be in the denominator. So, what we do now already the standard procedure: take the Gaussian integral, multi-dimensional Gaussian integral with respect to k. We did this many times. So, and I will write integral over ds from 0 to infinity, and we'll stand here square root of pi divided by s in power d, 1 over 2 pi in power d just from here, and e in power minus x prime absolute value of d squared divided by 4s. So we took the multidimensional Gaussian integral with respect to k, and here we do the following. We do one more substitution. T equal to 1 over s. And get the following. 1 over 2d. Then in denominator also we have pi in power d over 2. Integral from 0 to infinity dt times t in power d over 2 minus 2. E in power minus t. X minus x prime squared over 4. Here we have something that should give us what? Gamma function. So if you recall the definition of the gamma function, so a gamma of say a equal to integral from between 0 to infinity, t in power a minus 1, e minus t, dt. This is the definition of the gamma function if you remember it from Dan's course. So we just rescale. So rescale t by 4 divided by x minus x prime squared. If we do this simple step, then we arrive at our final result. That it is equal to one over 2 in power d pi d over 2 gamma d over 2 minus 1 times 4 divided by x minus x prime squared in power d over 2 minus 1. Any questions? How we managed to do this calculation? Okay, JJ, just I will take 5 more minutes, but not more. I am almost done with material for today's lecture. So any questions about this? Just let me then write down a couple of notes. For just the first, for d equal to 3, we have g of x minus x prime equal to 1 over 4 pi times 1 over x minus x prime. So if we want to solve, the following equation, minus nabla squared phi of x equal to 4 pi e times delta of x minus x prime. Can anyone tell me what e times delta of x minus x prime is?
It's the point chart.
It's the density of the point chart, right. So density of point chart. Then we use our expression for the Green's function. And write down the solution. You want to solve this, then phi of x will be equal to the integral over volume g x minus x prime times 4 pi e delta. It must be delta of x. No, not minus, of course. It was with the delta of x. So we assume that the point charge is at the origin. Yeah, of course. So we have phi of x equal to the integral over volume g of x minus x prime. And here we substitute the right-hand side taken at point x prime. 4 pi e delta of x prime integrating over dx prime. This is equal to 1 over 4 pi x minus x prime. And we get e divided by x, Coulomb's law. And finally, the last note. I will use this board. Note two. Let's look about the expression for the delta function. The question is it applicable for d equal to 2?
When d equals 2, you've got something to the power of 0, and it's just a constant.
Okay, okay.
Gamma of 0.
Oh, very, very good. So gamma of the argument d over 2 minus 1 spoils everything. This means that if you plug d equal to 2 in the above formula, then the Green's function is going to blow up. So this this is unacceptable. So one can ask a question, what is wrong? Whether the method itself is wrong, or you cannot simply use a Fourier transform method somehow to extract the Green's function. The answer to this question is very, very interesting. So the above mentioned g of x minus x prime is inapplicable for d equal to 2. But in this case, we still can have the expression for the Green's function. People use the formula that g of x minus x prime is equal to minus 1 over 2 pi logarithm of x minus x prime. You may ask a question, and what is the motivation for this formula? If you apply the Nabla operator to logarithm, then you get 0 everywhere except x minus x prime. But if you then try to check the validity of this equation, then what you have to do, you have to plug this expression into this equation and integrate both sides over x around point, say x prime, say that this is the point x prime, and you integrate over the circle. And you will, by applying the Gauss's theorem, convince yourself that this is the right expression for the Green's function. So the answer is that we can't use simply the method of eigenfunctions expansion to solve this equation in d equal to 2. But nevertheless, we can find something that satisfies this equation. And this is what people use when they consider the electrostatic problems in two dimensions. That's all. Thank you.